You may or may not be familiar with the music group Sugarland, but if you are, then you are very familiar with the song that I guess is known better than any of their others. It's called Stuck on Glue. And you are quite aware of those genius lyric words, I'm stuck on you, stuck like glue, whoa, whoa, you and me, baby, we're stuck like glue. What Sugarland didn't realize is that they had a pretty deep theological message there. And what they surely didn't realize is that they were quoting the Apostle Paul, albeit a very loose translation. And so this morning, I'd like for us to talk about that idea because of the seriousness of marriage. When we stand and give our vows and we talk about the idea of staying with someone till death do us apart, that's a very serious thing, but yet it's a very achievable thing. If it wasn't, God wouldn't have given it to us. And thus, as we think about that idea of staying with the same person until a member of that couple passes, God is saying, I want you there. I want you doing that, and I'm going to tell you how to do that. And so this morning, that's what I'd like for us to talk about. We're going to be spending quite a bit of time over in Ephesians chapter 5, one of the best known passages in the New Testament about marriage, but one that perhaps we don't always fully understand as we ought. And as we begin looking at this passage, the ideas there about nourishing and cherishing and respecting are going to be very key in that idea of being stuck like glue, of staying together. Oftentimes, when I have opportunity to teach teenagers lessons on marriage, I'll go through a lot of serious things and I'll pause and I'll say, okay, how many of you now are scared of getting married? And usually several of the hands will go up and I'll say, good, that was my intention. It's not that I want to scare anybody out of getting married, but in the culture in which we live, marriage is something that's not taken very seriously. And I don't need to tell you about the statistics and such that talk about the number of homes that are broken by divorce and people who are keeping to themselves and not working together to keep their marriages intact. We need to be scared in the sense of we are standing on the threshold of a very serious decision, a covenant that we are making in the presence of God, where we are saying to another person and we are saying to God, I am in this for the long haul, come what may. So, the Apostle Paul picks up with that idea in Ephesians chapter 5, and he tells us about it. And I want us to understand that with this passage, many times it is a very misunderstood passage in the sense of to whom it's directed. Usually when you mention this section of Scripture, the first thing that comes to mind is, oh, that's the passage on wives submitting to husbands. That is correct. When we look at verse 22, flat out says that, wives submit to your own husbands. Verse 23, the husband is head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and in himself its Savior. Now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to in everything to their husbands. That, however, is the introduction. When we get to the heart of this passage, this is a passage that is directed to men. It's directed to the husbands to say, here is how you behave yourself in this marriage. Here is what you do so that, in that introduction section, the wife can submit as she ought to the Lord. So let's follow that idea. And let's talk about it a bit, because when we pick up in verse 25, as Paul now addresses the husband and will for the next several verses, he says to the husband, everything that I'm about to tell you begins with the concept of love. In fact, you look there at the first part of 25, and he flat out says, husbands, love your wives. Point number one, that's a choice. That's not something you fall into. That's not something that you can fall into and then fall out of. It's a decision that you reach. However, we oftentimes miss that point because of kind of the squishy definition that the 21st century has of love. If I were to ask someone to define love, I can guarantee you I would come across several who would say, well, it's really not a word that you can define. It's not a concept you can put in words. Oh, yes, it is. And here they are. When the Apostle Paul uses this term, it says, the definition, to have a preference for, wish well to, regard the welfare of. That's a decision in every case. Who I am preferring, who I wish well, whose welfare I'm there to protect, that is the decision that Paul, right off the top of the passage here, says a husband must determine to do. Now, as we consider that idea, we have to understand as well in understanding this passage that it is the exact same word that's used to describe the Lord's desire for our salvation. Because what's going to follow after Paul's initial one of three commands in this section for the husband to love his wife, he then says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Now, I probably would, but I think it would be far fewer people who would say to me, if I asked for a definition of Christ's love, would say, well, that's just not really something you can put into words. We do put it into words. We just heard it put into words at this table, didn't we? Of what was done, of why it was done for Christ to love us and to act on that love. In what way? To prefer us, those who will follow Him, to wish well for us, to regard our welfare. That's what He did. And so Paul sets husbands on this very high trajectory of saying, as Christ did this for the church, you do this for your wife. Now, let's pursue that a bit. As we consider what Christ did, what Paul is going to tell us is that He formed a body with His believers. That in His act of love, as He loved the church, He came into this body with His believers, and we are united together within that body. Let's follow the passage down a bit here as we pick up at the end of verse 25 when he says, Christ loved the church and gave Himself up for her, that He might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the Word, so that He might present the church to Himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way husbands should love their wives as their own bodies, he who loves his wife loves himself. So here's the point. Because of Christ's love, He's invited us into this union. He's invited us into this body of believers. And He's done everything possible for us. Gave His life, gave the way. Now Paul uses that to say, okay, husbands, just as Christ has formed this body with believers and united with them, he says, you've got to form that body with your wife, and the two of you are united together. That's the whole idea. When the guy conducting the wedding says, you are no longer two, but one. Just as we are not outside of Christ, but one with Him, so the husband and the wife are united together and are one. Now, what Paul's going to do is pick up with that concept of body and pursue it. And he says, concerning the husband and his attitude, he says, you know, when you think about your own body, you nourish that body and you cherish that body. That's what he goes on to say as he completes this idea down in verse 28 and 29. Nobody ever hated his own body, but nourishes and cherishes it. So what about that concept of nourishment? What does that mean? It means that you're providing nurture for it. You're taking care of it. You're bringing it up to maturity. In other words, you are protecting yourself from all of the forces that could cause problems for your body. You're going to take care of things. But he goes on and he says, not only do you nourish your body, you also cherish your body. And again, we see an idea here of comforting. Going back to that idea of love that we looked at earlier, you're providing care, you're fostering this. Well, let's put all that together. And Paul says, now husbands, you know how to take care of yourselves. You know how to take care of your own body, but now that you form this union with your wife, that you are a body united together, you also nurture. And you also help in maturing, and you foster, and you comfort, and you care for. That's what a husband's role is. Now, very interesting thing. Both of these words are used one other time in the New Testament. Each one used one more time in the New Testament. Let me show you those. We don't have to go far for the first one. Over in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, again, to the men, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up. That's the exact same word as nourish that we look at earlier in chapter 5, in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. The second word, cherish, is used over in 2 Thessalonians when it says, but we were gentle among you like a nursing mother taking care of, same word we have there for cherish, her own children. That's 1 Thessalonians rather in the second chapter. Now, you've got both of those words. What do they have in common in these other passages? Both nourish and cherish are used in regards to children. So now the question comes. So are you saying a husband is to treat his wife like a child? Yes, but listen. He is to care for his wife as he cares for his children in this regard, because God has given him the responsibility of building a home that encourages spiritual growth. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Same command he has for his wife. He is to help bring her up in the sense of providing a place where her spiritual maturity is something very easy to attain. He has created an environment that is not hostile to God, that is not apathetic to God, but is pro-God in every way, so that just as his children are seeking to reach a higher level of spirituality, he is creating a home where his wife can do the exact same thing. He's encouraging that spiritual growth. He's promoting spiritual maturity. As I said, it's not an apathetic thing where the father says once or twice a month, let's go to church today. It's the idea that his family, children and wife included, can see in him a man who is eagerly concerned about them, who is wanting them to grow and promoting the kind of things that will aid in that. And he's going to foster that spiritual atmosphere. It's not going to be sporadic. It's not going to be a one and done. It's going to be a continual kind of thing. So, when Paul says to husbands, you nourish and cherish your wife, what he's saying is you now are responsible for helping her to grow as a Christian. What a sobering responsibility that he gives. But we're not done yet. Because as he finishes that idea, he immediately launches into this idea of leaving and cleaving. We look at where Paul says what we find back in the very beginning in the book of Genesis. He says, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And I understand this command is for husbands and wives both. Neither is to be clinging to their parents. But specifically, Paul is still here talking to men. And he says to the man, you shall leave your father and mother. That's a strong word. And in fact, the older translations make it much stronger than the new ones. It actually means to forsake. You forsake your father and mother. What does that not mean? That does not mean, well, you can no longer have a relationship with them. It does not mean you can't seek their opinion. It does not mean you don't have to care for them when they get old. That's not the concept. The concept is that husband realizes he is no longer a part of that household. When he takes his wife, he is no longer a part of his mother and father's house because he has begun his own house, where he is responsible, where he is the one who's going to foster and encourage people to do well, his family to do well in their obedience and service to God. So he's not always running home to mama to ask her opinion. He's not going to his father and saying, I just don't know what to do. Tell me, what do I need to do in this situation? Can he get their opinion? Absolutely. Should he bind himself to that opinion? Absolutely not. This is a decision for his body now. where he can make that determination with his wife, thinking along spiritual lines in making decisions like that. But let's look at a second phrase here. In this Genesis command, he says, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife. And here we come to the whole idea of the message behind the title of this lesson. Literally, what that means is you stick like glue. Paul is saying, when you forsake your family, your parents, and you start your own household, and you bring this wife into a body now where you're united together, you stick with her like glue. That's how you keep a marriage together. Again, let me make the point, this is a decision that a man makes. This is a choice that he makes. He does not say, well, I'm just bored with my wife now. We've run out of things that we have common interest in. None of that business. Paul says, when you have started your own household, you are going to stay with her till death do you part. Now, does anyone still think Ephesians 5 is written only to women? That he's just saying to women, you submit to your husbands? Paul is very, very challenging to husbands here that you provide that atmosphere. Now, once all of that's done, he comes back and he's got one more command for the wife here. And he says down in verse 33, however, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. That's interesting. I'm going to give you a very non-politically correct definition of what respect means. What that word literally means is reverential obedience. It's not reverence to the husband, though. It's reverence to God. Just as the Apostle Paul will say, children, obey your parents in the Lord. That's what's going on here. Wives, you respect your husbands in the Lord. You're reverencing the Lord by the obedience that you show in this godly submission. Why is that? It's because the wife is voluntarily submitted. She said, okay, I'm in this. I'm becoming a part of this body. I'm becoming a part of this household, united together. And when she does that, she is respecting his work in creating that godly home. Does that mean there will never be a disagreement? Does that mean there will never be a difference of opinion on the direction one should go? Absolutely not. You've got two people who have thoughts that are going on, but what it means is she is not working against him in his goal of creating a home where God is being honored. That's what the apostle says. Now, with all that in mind, we got to realize that there are things that place a great deal of stress on that glue. That when a husband and wife are stuck together, there are a lot of things that are working against that glue holding. Some of these very, very good things, yet, if not considered appropriately in this relationship, can tear a family apart. I want to start with one that may be the most unusual of the list. That's children. There's been a lot of research done in this area, and I was just looking as I was preparing for this lesson as all the studies. I don't know a lot about Michael Johnson other than he bills himself a professor of psychology, but yet he writes in very simple terms what a lot of studies have found. He says, for around 30 years, researchers have studied how having children affects a marriage, and the results are conclusive. The relationship between spouses suffers once kids come along. Comparing couples with and without children, researchers have found that the rate of the decline in relationship satisfaction is nearly twice as steep for couples who have children than for childless couples. In the event that a pregnancy is unplanned, the parents experience even greater negative impacts on their relationship. The irony is that even as the marital satisfaction of new parents declines, the likelihood of them divorcing also declines. Here's his opinion on it. So having children may make you miserable, but you're miserable together. Worse still, the decrease in marital satisfaction likely leads to a change in general happiness. Because the biggest predictor of overall life satisfaction is one satisfaction with their spouse. I think that's the most interesting thing he said. Is this an encouragement not to have children? Absolutely not. But it is a realization that when children come along, there is now a stress on this marriage that was not there before. Whereas before, if you wanted to pick up and go, you could pick up and go. But now you can't do that as easily. And now there's somebody else in that household that's vying for attention, lots of attention. So how do you keep the marriage together? Well, one thing, and I think all of these studies bring this out, that what can make things even more stressful is when you have a missing in action parent. When you've got one parent who continues living kind of like a member of a childless couple, and all of the work falls on the other in discipline, in care, in transportation, and in all of these things that go with raising a child. And I think we're not stating anything that's outside the obvious when we say usually that's going to fall on the mother in the family. Happy Mother's Day, right? We all know that. That the mother is going to be the one most of the time who's going to bear the brunt when that situation occurs. That's going to put stress on keeping that glue bond together. Children are a joint effort. When a man and woman make the decision to bring a child into the world, it needs to be with sobriety that this child is going to be brought into a household where God is loved, where the parents love each other, and where the child is loved in that order. Because that's going to make a household work. That's going to make that glue hold, even though there may be lots of stresses here that could end that marriage. You've got a couple who's committed to God and one another, and they're simply not going to allow that to take place. But let me give this little word of admonition. Over-attentiveness to a child can also create stress. And I think there are times when that occurs, that you'll have a parent who is paying more attention to the child than the parent is paying to the spouse. It's easy to do. It's very easy to do. However, that's one of the things I think these studies bear out that bring to that lack of satisfaction within marriage and thus a lack of satisfaction with life in general. This can happen in lots of ways. You know, I think sometimes fathers can fall into this when they have a child who's a pretty good athlete. And they spend all those hours and hours practicing whatever sport it is to the neglect of the wife at home. That's a danger. That's a difficulty that can lead to that kind of bond being broken. And so fathers in particular must remember Ephesians 6:4. It's your responsibility, fathers, to create that household where God is honored, where children are being brought up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And the way that ties into our thought is a good marriage is a part of that. How do children learn how to have a good marriage? The best way they can do that is to see the two main people in their lives together in that good marriage. That's training. That's nurturing. That's encouraging. And fathers are going to play a very leading role in that. And mothers, of course, are going to play an essential role in that occurring. So let me just say this. Parents, sometimes the best thing for your marriage is learning how to tell your child no. And what I mean by that is, a child who misses some activities growing up, it's not going to be negatively impacted. In all these years I've been around kids, one of the things I have seen markedly in my career is the number of things kids are involved in. Whereas a few years ago you had your season, now if you desire, you can play ball 12 months out of the year. You can take classes on anything you want to do. You can join whatever organization. Let me tell you, wherever that child goes, a parent's got to go. There's got to be transportation and time spent. Missing some of those is not going to be a detriment to that child, but a bad home life will be. Parents who are not working to keep that glue bond together are going to have a negative impact on their children. So sometimes it's simply a matter of saying, no, I think we can let that go. That's going to interfere too much in our family time. That's going to keep one of us on the road too much. And there will be some pouting and tears and crying. But parents ought to be used to that. Because what they realize is the hard stance they're taking now is going to have a good impact in the years to come. I think as well as we consider those stressful things, it's important for us to realize that wherever we are, we seize that opportunity to bond. Don't let me give you the wrong opinion. I have spent a lot of time at the ball field. However, 99% of the time, there's somebody sitting right beside me in the lawn chair who I made a commitment to about 23 years ago. We do a lot of talking. We do a lot of planning, sitting there watching warm-ups, halftime. Parents, don't miss those occasions. Don't be off talking to someone else when here is the perfect opportunity for that bonding to take place in the midst of a very busy life. You can make it work. It's just a matter of wanting to. Let me say as well that if we're not awfully careful, our work lives put a great deal of stress on this. Because there's a real danger of neglect. And what we must understand is that getting ahead in life never, ever, ever means leaving our spouses behind. That if we are going to be people who are true to that bond, work, as important as that is and necessary as that is for our family, is never allowed to take precedence over the love that I show for my spouse. When we talk about being economically comfortable, that's a nice thing. Not having to worry where our next meal's coming from, not have to worry about the house being foreclosed on, that's good. But those things must always be secondary to marital comfort. When I make a commitment to someone till death do us part, that means that person comes first in everything. We live in a time that makes that very difficult. And I think the words of Jesus, as I've mentioned before, I seem to come back to more and more. When He says in that parable of the sower, as for what was sown among thorns, this is the one who hears the word. But the cares of the world, that's what we just talked about, and the deceitfulness of riches, this is what we're talking about, choke the word. It chokes the marriage too. Because I'm not being what God told me to be. I'm not being the husband. I'm not being the wife that God directs me to be. And that marriage will prove unfruitful. So what does that mean? It means I've got to understand the danger of being consumed by what I do. I don't know of many people who leave work behind, who have the kind of job who say, okay, when I punch out at 4 o'clock, I'm done till tomorrow morning. Don't have anything to think about, nothing to do. Most of us are employed after we leave work. That makes it even more trying. Because if we are not careful, we allow that to consume us, and our technology has made it even worse because 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we are connected to our boss, we're connected to our fellow workers, we're connected to our clients, we're connected to the contract we're trying to get. And we've got texts coming in and emails coming in. We don't have to wait by the mailbox anymore. They're there. What does that mean? It means if I'm not awfully careful, I'm going to allow that to consume me. Might I just say your spouse wants you at dinner, not your workplace? Your spouse needs to talk to you, doesn't need to look at you talking to someone on your phone. Neither of you need to eat a meal where you're both staring at a screen. These are the things that build the bond, and they seem so small and they seem so insignificant. But studies continue to be shown that the family dinner table is one of the strongest home builders that there is. I can assure you the same goes for marriage. We cannot allow ourselves to grow so consumed that we're neglecting our spouse for our workplace. Let me mention also this. I think it's a very good thing for men and women to have friends who are of the same gender. I think we see that biblically, don't we? I think of David and Jonathan, where at one point David, in his deep distress, says, Jonathan, you can understand things better than a woman can. I think what he's saying is, you know what I'm going through. I think about Ruth and Naomi and the bond of friendship that existed there where they saw the needs of each other. That's a good thing. And it's something that I think needs to be developed. But you know where I'm about to go. The danger with this is when these outside friendships crowd out one spouse. When we allow these things to take precedence over the time and attention that needs to go to the one to whom we're married. Therefore, we have to be awfully careful about that. Again, our time, the time we spend with someone, the time in calls and texts and outings, all of those may be good and fun and actually uplifting and upbuilding, but they're always secondary. I never show the neglect to my spouse in order to make these things take place. Therefore, they've got to be kept to a minimum. Let me also mention this. There's also a great danger in opposite gender friendships. I'm not discouraging those. I think there are occasions where it's very easy for man and woman to have a good, friendly relationship and no problems there. But there's always a danger. There's always a temptation. And if one maintains friendships like this, one must always realize those dangers and always, always make sure you're considering your spouse. Never, ever, ever leave room for suspicion. I can tell you one of the first things Pam and I did when we got our cell phones is we told each other our passwords. I can go to her phone. I can see who she's called. She can go to my phone, see who I've called. That's fine. And that's the way it needs to be. And when husbands and wives have these kinds of relationships, the first person they need to tell probably about most every conversation is their spouse. I saw so-and-so today. This is what we talked about. This is where we were. Doesn't have to be a big deal, a casual thing, but it keeps suspicion away. And if somebody ever comes and says, you know, I saw your husband talking to her over there, the wife can say, oh yeah, this is what they were talking about. This is how long the conversation lasted. That's a good way of ending rumors, isn't it? Good way of ending suspicions. And thus we must realize that something as good and godly and biblical as friendships are, that we must never allow them to be the things that are going to break the glue bond of a marriage. And what ties all of this together? It's time. With all of these things, that's what it's about. It applies to every situation. Children, workplace, friendships, whatever we add to that list. When a couple spends time together, productive time together, that's going to be the best defense they have against the encroaching dangers that could break up a marriage. And thus, we must understand nourishing and cherishing require time. It's not going to happen without it. But as I close, may I also make this point. Everything we've talked about applies to our relationship with Christ. Everything that can break the bond of a marriage between a man and woman can break the bond of the marriage with Jesus Christ. And if that happens, everything suffers, including marriage. And so if I'm someone who's not really serious about my relationship with Christ, I've broken that bond with Him, that means I'm also harming that bond with my wife, getting a little off topic, but also harming that bond with my children. You see, Christ is everything and must be our everything. And every marriage has got to grow out of that relationship with Christ if it's going to be the kind of marriage ordained in Ephesians chapter 5. So here's my admonition for me. And if you can benefit, please do. Take your marriage seriously, because God sure does. And God has said, I want this to be the strongest bond outside of your bond with me. And I must do everything I can to make that bond work. But as stated, Christ has got to come first. That's what's going to make it happen. So this morning, if you're married, or planning on getting married, or even have the thought that one day you might get married, take these words seriously. They're not mine. They're God's. God has said, I want this to be something that allows my light to shine through you. that in marriage, you're helping someone else to make it to heaven. But let me also say to those who are not Christians, you need to get married today. Christ describes His relationship with His bodies as a marriage. That He comes and He's the groom and the church is His bride. And He's done everything He can to make this body. He's nourished and He's cherished, even to giving His very life in love. But you've got to say, I do. It's not going to be a shotgun marriage. It's not going to be one where God makes you make that decision. It's completely your choice. But may I just ask you this morning, why wouldn't you? When you see what's been done and what's been promised, now's the time to be washed with the water. Through the grace of God, to have your sins taken away. Or if you realize you've not been true to that marriage, you've not taken it seriously in whatever way, whether that be in your family life or your work life or wherever, if you'd like for us to pray with you this morning about that, we'll be glad to do that. Going with you to the throne room of heaven to beseech the Father's help. Whatever you need to do to be right with the Lord, won't you answer His call as we stand and sing?